To repeat, first of all, national Republicans were convinced that war would resume. And yet again, they were convinced the enemy must be Britain. There was every reason to believe that this was just another interval in a never-ending war. Jefferson, for instance, commented on this frequently until his death. He was convinced that Napoleon had perverted the French Revolution. Europe had been inundated in rivers of blood, as he put it, and more blood would have to flow in the future because the Republican Revolution was not yet complete in Europe. Before the world could become a better place, every old nation of Europe would have to have a Republican Revolution. And Jefferson was eager to have them pay the price in blood. Jefferson, of course, is famous for talking about how the tree of liberty should be manured with the blood of patriots and all this nice stuff. This bloodthirstiness is a major motif in Jefferson's thought throughout. He didn't look at the world in 1815 and say, you know, the European system is exhausted through the Napoleonic cataclysm. They've had enough. Maybe they'll chill for a while and not kill each other. In fact, that's what, of course, the Concert of Vienna achieved. And the Holy Alliance was not very important. Basically, Europe enjoys peace during the 19th century. America doesn't. That's the irony. But Jefferson was convinced that there would have to be another bloodbath in Europe because he was absolutely convinced that republicanism was the future. Of course, the downside of that is as long as Europe is in flames and blood is flowing, to use whatever gory images you like, then America can't steer clear of this. And so this is a strong argument for a protective national state, for a strong policy to strengthen the Union against future threats. So as I've indicated, national Republicans, proceeding from the premise that there would be another war, wanted to prepare. And one of the ways to prepare was to protect American industry against European competition. Because in time of war, two things happen. One, manufacturers can't be imported, and therefore you can't have import duties. The American government lives on import duties in this period. If they are eliminated, you don't have any revenue at precisely the time you need to fight wars. Second, when you fight a war, you've got to have the materiel. You've got to be able to manufacture everything from guns to soldiers' uniforms. You've got to mobilize your economy as well as your manpower in order to fight that war. So what you need is a manufacturing sector in America. And that's what America already had, thanks to the War of 1812 and the embargo. There was a long period in which American manufacturers, mercantile capital, went into manufacturing, and infant industries mushroomed in the Philadelphia and the Delaware Valley and in New England. And so what these new industries needed was protection. They needed to be protected against the importation of cheap English manufactured goods that would destroy these industries. If they destroyed those industries, that was as good as making war on America. Remember, England's the great enemy, and England can get us in two ways. They can get us by exercising superior military power, or they can get us by exercising superior economic power. And so these nationalists or national Republicans want to meet both threats, to prepare for the next hot war, but in the meantime to win the Cold War in peacetime by developing the national economy. So this is what I'm describing as a realist position. Peace is not the imminent tendency of the system as a whole. Peace is something that is maintained by governmental power, by the Union, among the states. That's where peace exists. National development depends on promoting the manufacturers. Now, why wouldn't all Americans agree to this nationalist policy initiative? And this is really comes down to the answer to my big question of why we have the Civil War. And simply, any policy that promotes one sector of the economy, I'm really excited about it. I'm trying to communicate this. Any policy that fosters one sector of the economy is going to have a differential impact throughout the country. In other words, sectoral interests, to use economic talk, the development of manufacturing is going to have a sectional impact. In other words, if we promote manufacturers, that's good for the manufacturing states. It's not so good for the staple-producing export states. Why is that? Because staple-producing export states, and I'm talking particularly about southern cotton producers, they want the best price for their cotton. They're going to get the best price under a regime of free trade. If we erect high tariffs to keep out British manufacturers, the British will retaliate. You'll have commercial warfare. There'll be high tariffs against American importations. And besides, the Southerners say, we have to trade for something. What are we going to get? And what they're convinced is that under the tariff, Southerners become convinced that they're paying a tax that is redistributive. They are, in effect, subsidizing Northern manufacturers. That is the absolute conviction of Southerners. In other words, that's the important point, the differential sectional impact. But it's not just interest. And I'd love to keep it at just interest and say Southerners, of course, they're nasty, they're slaveholders. Let's just dump on Southerners. And it's just nasty self-interest, sordid self-interest that's involved here. But there's also a judgment which is authorized by the classical economists that, in fact, forcing manufacturers prematurely comes at the cost of the entire economy. Yeah, you could force manufacturers, you could have a textile industry, but the sum total of the wealth of the nation, to borrow a phrase from Adam Smith, is going to be diminished because the United States is not exploiting its comparative advantage in international trade. Until we have a sufficiently large population, an internal market, and a labor supply that's cheap enough, it doesn't make any sense to have manufacturers. So, yeah, a few manufacturers go down without protection, but that's too bad for them personally, but it's better for the country and for the larger good of the whole country not to have protection. But as I indicated before, there's even a third dimension. It's not just a judgment of what's good for the whole economy and therefore the whole country, because, of course, the wealth of a nation is crucial to its power and ultimately to its ability to vindicate its rights. The final thing is the vision that these folks have that the world is becoming progressively a better place. And why is it becoming a better place? It's because throughout the Western trading world, people are reading Adam Smith and they're saying, mercantilism, it doesn't work. We can't regulate this trade. It's in our interest to eliminate trade barriers. This is happening, supposedly, and it takes a long time through the 19th century for it to happen. In fact, it's not until the 1840s that the British themselves eliminate their corn laws, which keep out American grain from the British market. Still, that's the tendency. That's all the talk that's coming out of Britain about how free trade is the future, and a future of prosperity and of peace. The revolutionaries, of course, had sought to escape from the entanglements of European politics. The National Republicans say, to sustain our independence, we must develop a strong state. But then the free traders say, what exactly is the point of independence if it merely means that the new nation we create is a nation that will be making war, that will be drawn constantly into wars that it provokes? So there's a real question about the meaning of independence. The free traders would say genuine independence follows from interdependence in a global economy. And they say the advance of one nation is not at the expense of others. All nations will rise together as the trajectory of prosperity rises through increased world trade. As I've said before, my free traders, these Southerners, are cosmopolitan liberals. They're progressives. And they see themselves as the genuine legatees of the American Revolution. So here's our interesting juxtaposition. The true patriots, as they see themselves, and believe me, Southern slaveholding cotton planters see themselves as great patriots. They see that what patriotism requires is growing interdependence and free trade in the Atlantic economy. Their opponents, the protectionists, are seen as warmongers who want to create a strong state that will provoke war. In other words, what the Southerners do is to say, what you Northerners are doing is trying to recreate the British imperial mercantile state. That's what we fought our revolution against. Now, the wonderful thing that happens, this is the short version of the story that I could elaborate over the next several hours. What happens, everything in the history of this period revolves around how Americans think about England. Because both these visions that I've described, the free trade and the protectionist vision, are focused on England. The protectionists want to protect against and compete effectively against what they call British free trade imperialism. Free traders, on the other hand, say, you know, we've discovered something. After all, Britain is not our great enemy. It's our great customer. Now, this is the crucial point. This is really important. When free traders say that the condition of the world is naturally peaceful and progressive, and they say that the best possible relationships are ones that are based on reciprocal exchange, in other words, trade, foreign trade is the true cement or bond of union. Keep that phrase in mind, bond of union. The most beneficial relations we have are with our trading partners. In other words, they're beginning to think that the real union is between the cotton South and Britain, because that's where we have a real complementarity. That's the true union. That obviously in material terms makes sense. Yes, this is where they make their money. This is where their living is. But what's wonderfully ironic about it is that the people who begin arguing for this Anglo-American alliance, economic alliance, free trade alliance, began their careers as Anglophobes, as England haters. That was the marrow, the central message of Jeffersonianism. You gotta hate the English. But Jefferson's Anglophobia was just Anglophilia turned inside out. And the Anglophobia of Southern Jeffersonian Republicans morphed into Anglophilia in the 1820s and 1830s. And they found themselves arguing that the real interest of patriotic Americans was in cultivating union with Britain. Meanwhile, you recall, the protectionists say, we're going to keep having wars, and they're going to be wars with Britain. So we have two different images of Britain's role in the geopolitics of the Atlantic world. Now, if you agree with the free traders, then you say, as David Ricardo did, the great British economist, that the tendency of the world trading system is toward a universal society of nations. Now, doesn't that give you a warm feeling? You say, oh, yeah, that's great. Dismantle the warfare states. I mean, I'm a relic of the 60s. It sounds good to me. So the natural alliance is between Britain and America. What does that mean make relations within the Union between the North and the South? That's the contrast I want you to think about. Because increasingly, remember I talked about the 40 bale theory, about this redistributive tax, the tariff takes money from the South and gives it to the North, this terrible tax, and if there's anything that makes Americans mad, it's taxes. Well, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to tax us down here in the South. Now, they're doing it under the forms of majority rule. They control Congress. You know how they do it, the protectionists? Well, I'll tell you how they do it. Through corrupt log rolling, they put together this unholy alliance, to coin a phrase, of sordid corrupt interests. And they say, I roll your log, you roll mine. I help you, you help me. And so you put together just enough voters. And so you have what is ostensibly majority rule, but it's being used in order to take the wealth of one part of the country and give it to another. You know, Southerners in the period leading up to the Civil War, famous for turning away from democracy and majority rule. Well, this is the reason. It's because of the way they see the federal system operating. Because they see through Republican government. They see through majority rule. And they see that this is just an insidious way for the North to make war on the South without having to send troops into the field. They just take our wealth from us. Isn't that what wars are supposed to do? It's that sense of sectional grievance that's absolutely crucial to the coming of the Civil War. So this is the contrast between these relatively benign reciprocal relationships between trading nations in the Atlantic world, which is naturally peaceful. If it's naturally peaceful, then why do we need a collective security arrangement? We pay a tax, and what do we get for it? We don't get protection from war because there's no danger of war. In fact, quite to the contrary, we have a war-making state that we're subsidizing that will suck us into war. They want to make war with Britain. Are you sympathizing with the Southerners? That's why it was so important for me to establish my credentials as a neo-Confederate-hating Yankee. Because that argument, it was pretty powerful, wasn't it? I mean, you said, oh, I'm swept away. So Southerners say the most pathetic, tiny little, this is a loose quote, the most pathetic, tiny little nation in Europe, surrounded by ravenous, tyrannical monarchies, is better off than poor South Carolina in the Union. Why? Because at least that poor, pathetic little state can use the balance of power, try to gain security. Every other state will want to cancel each other out in order to preserve the independence of that state. But rather than anybody caring about preserving South Carolina's interests, instead what we have is this coalition of our enemies within the Union to take our wealth from us. So he says this. This is George McDuffie, and there are several other quotes to this effect. John C. Calhoun says it. We'd be better off outside of the Union. They're saying this as early as the 1820s, and they keep saying it up until the time of the Civil War. And they say it because they don't believe the Union does anything for them. Even though the Founding Fathers had said, the reason we have a Union is to preserve the peace. And they kept saying that to themselves. Yes, honored fathers, we agree with you. We don't want to have a bloody civil war, but how long do we submit to this Cold War? How long do we allow them to do this to us? Yes, there will be a war, but maybe it's a war we have to fight. Many people think that the Civil War came out of inadvertence, that nobody wanted it. It was just a bad sequence of events. I think these people knew exactly what was going to happen. They knew it was going to be a bloody war. That was the whole point of the Union. They were brought up under the gospel of the Union. They knew that the Union was the only thing that made America different from Europe. But no matter how much you believe that, remember, it's a fragile balance that I was talking about. Well, Southerners were convinced that the balance had shifted irrevocably away from them, that the Union was no longer the Union that the fathers had created, that it was now but a shell, a pretext, a pretense for the theft of their wealth. In other words, the Union was no longer a peace plan, as I described it earlier in the intentions of the founders. Instead, that whole idea was turned inside out. And so people like Thomas Cooper, as early as 1824, the great South Carolina crank and economist, says, we must calculate the value of our Union. What price do we pay? As soon as you start using this language, the language of calculation, of cost-benefit analysis, then it's too late because you have demystified the Union. It no longer has the aura, that aura of perfection that was so important to the founders, that miraculous aura, that thing that we did, that we Americans did, that represented a step forward for mankind, our great contribution to the history of political thought, federalism. Now, we have to calculate its value. And I don't think it pays. Well, what's the result of all this? I guess you knew that. That's this dark cloud looming over your collective imagination. You say 600,000 guys are going to get killed. How many families are going to be ruptured? In the meantime, I've told you about how the free traders think about things. Well, there's, of course, another view, and that's the view of their opponents, the protectionists. Now, the protectionists lose the battle over the tariff, but they win another battle, because what the protectionists really do as they define their position, the need to develop the national economy, the protectionists are the real inventors of the modern American idea of the nation. Because their conception of the Union is not as one in which we have this balance of discrete and different autonomous sections and states. Instead, they begin to redefine the Union in economic terms, in terms of interdependent interests, the development of a balanced national economy, focusing on the home market, the central importance of a market for the goods of all sections that Americans will provide for themselves. And in doing this, they appropriate the idea of domesticity of the home to that notion of home market, and they begin to talk about the nation, a nation that includes all the sections of the country, in terms very much like those of Romantic nationalists of 19th century Europe. They begin to talk nation talk. So here's your odd juxtaposition. As Whig Unionists are talking nation talk, North and South, we have free traders and alienated Southerners who are talking about nation-breaking talk, who are talking about how the Union is unnecessary, who ban the use of the word nation itself. They say, you may not say nation if you're going to be politically acceptable in free trade circles, because there is no such thing as the nation. They recognize the danger. If you say nation, if you believe nation, then a nation can do anything it needs to do for its own development and security. But Cooper, my old friend, says, no, nation is just a high-sounding word. It doesn't mean a thing. There is no such thing as the general welfare. Those are fighting words in American constitutional history. Those elastic clauses that allow loose constructionists to run roughshod over our liberties. So we have these two opposing discourses. I started by talking about different discourses or attitudes toward the way the world is organizing. It's naturally peaceful, it's naturally at war. And I've finished, am finishing by talking about two distinctive, call them constitutional discourses about the nature of the American Union. Is it a nation? Or is it a league of independent sovereign states whose value must be calculated? Well, the upshot of all this is secession. And what does secession mean? Secession doesn't mean the triumph of the cosmopolitan free trade idea. It means that the Southerners, the great opponents of the idea of nation, have to reinvent the idea of nation. The Southerners, that was the title of the talk, two nations. The invention of two nations. Southerners, now why do they become a nation? Why do they turn away from free trade? Well, they'd won that battle a long time ago. But what they needed now was recognition in the world of nations if they were going to secure themselves against all threats. The threat of the North, whether or not the North goes to war right away, you have to be ready for that war. Does that sound familiar? You've got to be prepared for the next war. Well, Southerners know they have to be prepared for the next war. And remember, I said all these people have almost a fatalistic conviction that there will be a war. The bloody talk is all over the place. They talk about it. Southerners think they're going to succeed in their nation-making project. Now, why do they want to make a nation? As I say, it's because they're going to have to make war, and they're going to have to prepare for war. And that's what nations are all about, as I've indicated. In other words, they become, for all practical purposes, realists. They move past their idealism. They think, because of King Cotton, that they hold a commanding position in the economic balance of power in the Atlantic system. They will bring England to its knees if England does not recognize the Confederacy. Too bad they produced so much cotton in the previous years that the British had a surplus of cotton, and they could wait out the first year and a half in the war. So, oh, yeah. Still, it was a near thing. The economic power of the South could not be, should not be dismissed. They could also seize on the idea of 1848. That was, of course, the great year of failed revolutions throughout Europe, national revolutions. The national idea seizes the European imagination in 1848. And if those revolutions failed, nonetheless, the idea took hold. And all enlightened opinion in the Western world now agreed that nations should determine their own destiny. Now, who gets to say who is a nation? Well, Southerners said they were. They knew they were a distinct people because they had been oppressed and aggrieved under the tyranny of Yankee rule under the forms of the Union for the last 30 years, notwithstanding that this is the most prosperous part of the country and they're doing very well, thank you, but that's not something they're prepared to recognize. So they think they're a people, and they think that European nations must recognize their nationhood because they're proclaiming it and they're prepared to vindicate it on the battlefield. And of course, they think they'll win. And finally, this is the most repelling part of my talk. I save it for last. But the other reason that Southerners think they're going to win is because they think that their nation is a progressive and civilized nation. We say, how could they say it? Well, it's because Southerners believed that their system of slavery, as it had been progressively reformed over the previous 30 years, was the most enlightened possible solution to a problem that everybody in the West recognized. And that was, how would the lighter-skinned peoples of the temperate zone, the truly advanced commercial economic societies of the temperate zone, deal with darker-skinned people of the tropics? I want you to think about the slavery problem, which we think of in American, narrow American terms, and it revolves around the injustice of the institution of slavery. I just ask you for a moment to think with Southern progressives about slavery as merely part of a larger problem of how the races will be related to each other in the future. Think of what Rudyard Kipling would later call the white man's burden. Think about what the British Empire needs to accomplish, the second British Empire, as it extends its rule across the globe, in India, in other places, in Africa later, in places where darker-skinned people needed the guiding hand of European masters. This is, of course, something that we find utterly objectionable now, but it puts into context the pro-slavery defense. Southerners did not think they were disqualified from participation in the family of nations because they had racial slavery. It was more likely that they would be disqualified in 1800 or in 1776 when enlightened opinion turned against slavery than in 1860 when racial science, all the really educated big thinkers, the professors, I hate to say, who thought about the problem of the races, were convinced that there was a hierarchy of races. And that since we're talking about the great century of globalization in which one civilization dominates the world, then the question of the races becomes compelling. How do the Europeans, the great nations of the temperate zone, govern and control the rest of the world for its own good? For all these reasons, the Southerners had every reason to think that their project of nationhood would win acceptance and recognition, if not for sentimental reasons by fellow nationalists across the world, certainly for interested reasons from their trading, by their trading partners, or finally because they would vindicate those claims on the field of battle. In doing so, in risking war, and they knew they were risking war, the rebels unleashed the dogs of war, and fulfilled the worst nightmare that the Founding Fathers had had.